$9 billion. That's the price tag for funding the National Disability Insurance Scheme. The government wants to fund the NDIS by increasing the Medicare levy by 0.5% for those earning over $22,000. Labor, well, you'll remember, they came up with the NDIS. They want to increase the levy, but only for higher income earners. So it's up to the government to convince the Senate crossbench. Compromise is the byword for the 45th Parliament, as we saw with company tax cuts. So how will the government's plan to fund the insurance scheme be modified in the upper house? Christian Porter is the Minister for Social Services. He's in our Parliament House studio. Welcome back to the program.
Yeah, good to be back.
How much are you going to have to alter your plan to fund the NDIS to get it through the Senate?
Well, it's a very loaded question, Patricia. I don't think that it'll need to be changed at all. I think the reason why this will gain support amongst the crossbench in the Senate is because it's precisely the same mechanism that the Labor Party agreed was completely fair in 2013. Everyone in the disability sector is supportive of this being the mechanism. It's a mechanism where people with much, much more pay more in terms of their contribution. People with less pay far less. But ultimately, for the average income earner, it means about a dollar a day ensures the full funding of the NDIS, and that ensures that every single Australian and their family have protection against events that might happen in their lives that could see them needing disability care into the future.
So you have the numbers on the crossbench already? It's a done deal?
That is a process and not an answer that anyone in government can rationally give at the beginning of the process. But you're asking me, what do I think is going to happen? My view is that because this has wide support in the disability sector, because Australians understand that it is the best insurance policy anyone in the world could ever get against the misfortune of having to suffer and have all of the challenges of a disability in their future or their family's future, this will get supported in the crossbench in the Senate.
So to be clear, you will not consider raising the threshold, currently just under 22,000,
Right. So you'll see that the Treasurer's recently introduced legislation which indexes the thresholds up, there's a whole range of carve-outs for people on those very low incomes. But what this does allow is that people on lower incomes pay much, much less. So, for instance, someone whose income might be seven times greater than one of the low-income earners who pays the Medicare levy will pay 13 or 14 times more in terms of their contribution to filling this final funding gap. Now, we think that's a very fair and progressive system that allows for the filling of the funding gap. And, you know, who was arguing that it's unfair? I mean, Labor argued vigorously in 2013 this is the absolute fairest way to fund the NDIS.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Christian Porter. He's the Minister for Social Services. And the number, if you want to text in, is 0418 226 576. Labor wants a royal commission into allegations of violence and abuse of Australians with disabilities. The Prime Minister said he'll raise this in COAG, but is not committed to a royal commission. Isn't this at a point now, though, of crisis? Isn't this something that you have to look at? I mean, you can't just sort of say that the states should look at this.
Well, there's no question that abuse of people with a disability in care or in service settings is absolutely abhorrent and unacceptable. Equally, it's the case that there have been some real, real problems in various state jurisdictions in the past. But it's also the case that this week, that system starts the process of very significant change. And up until this point, the quality and assurance of care for Australians with a disability was conducted in states by states under state regimes. And the regimes and the standards would differ from state to state, and the quality of compliance would differ from state to state. Now, what we've agreed over the last 18 months through the reform process of the NDIS is that there will be a new set of quality and safeguard frameworks, which is effectively new stringent standards, and there will be a single independent Commonwealth body, which we've now funded in this budget to the tune of $209 million, and that will be the body that applies those standards, that regulates service providers, but also becomes the body that hears complaints where people need to uphold their rights in a service provision context. Now, we think, and all of the states agree, this is a very, very significant reform. It effectively changes in the most significant way the landscape where we have had quality and assurance exacted in Australia.
Christian Porter, so there's no way you'll look at a royal commission here?
Well, our view is that the best thing that we can do is to prevent what we've seen in the past happening in the future. The best way to do that is significantly reform the system. The way to do that is design new quality and assurance framework rules and have a new, single, consistent, clear body identified, which will operate a bit like an ombudsman operates, establish that and have somewhere for people to go with their complaints where they can be absolutely assured they'll be listened to, the complaints will be acted upon. So what we're doing is actually changing the system that caused the problems. Now, some people might take an alternative view that it is a better use of time and resources to investigate the system that's about to be changed. You note that the Labor Party has recently taken that view. I would also note that they haven't taken that view for the last 18 months. And in fact, they actually voted against a Royal Commission in the Senate this March 2017.
Okay.
Well, it's a very serious problem. The question's about a consistent approach to try and solve the problem. And we've developed that approach, and that legislation's appearing this week. Isn't it much, much better to fix the system that caused the problems rather than spend massive time and resources investigating a system that you are right now about to substantially change?
On welfare reform, you've previously cited New Zealand's experience as the model to follow. You've said this investment approach, which Patrick McClure mentioned very much front and centre in his report, was the way to look at this, this actuarial approach, which spends the money up front in difficult cases rather than later down the line. And yet there's very little talk about this now. Is this something you still want to embrace?
I talk about it every opportunity I'd get, and thanks for giving us another opportunity. But yes, what New Zealand did was they used data systems and platforming their data to try and look at and work out who were the groups inside the welfare system that had the worst long-term trajectory in the system and that handed on welfare dependency to their children. Now, we basically have copied that data system and we've been able to identify people who have very poor outcomes in the welfare system. The types of groups we're talking about, young carers are one group, young single mothers are another group, students who fail their studies and go on to Newstart. And as we go through the reform process that we have engaged in this budget, we can see also that people who have difficulties with drug and alcohol in the system have very bad results.
You're not putting the vast upfront money that the New Zealand approach does. You're not actually embracing the full model, which would be a huge investment upfront in a bigger group of people to try and turn this around.
Well, again, I would dispute that. So we've set up what we call a Tri-Test Learn Fund, which is designed to target those three groups, young mums, young students who've gone on to Newstart, try and target those groups with $100 million, where we go to the non-government sector and they design plans to target those groups and we pay them to engage in that targeted assistance to those individual groups. In this budget, around about $260 million, so $250 million, has been invested specifically in helping young mums prepare for work. Now, I just don't believe, when you look over the budget papers, that it's a fair observation to make that somehow there isn't significant upfront investment. In this budget, we rewrite mutual obligation and compliance rules, and in large part, that costs us money. So, for instance, rewriting the mutual obligation rules costs $47 million because more people will be more actively engaged with job service providers that through the taxpayers, the government funds to ensure people that transition from unemployment into work. So this is not about saving money. In actual fact, it involves large amounts of spending to try and activate people who, at the moment, the data shows us have really bad results inside the welfare system.
Well, let's talk about another area where you're doing something really controversial, and that's this random drug testing of welfare recipients, young welfare recipients in these trial areas. The Prime Minister has said that his evidence for doing this is love. Do you have any real evidence, or are you just going to base it on an emotion?
That's not at all what the Prime Minister said, and I think that's rather an unfair misrepresentation.
Well, he was asked, what's his evidence? He was asked. No, that was the question he was asked.
What he said is that we are motivated by care for the people that we are trying to assist. This is about assisting people, and what happens inside the system at the moment is that people are able to write themselves out of their mutual obligations to search for and attain work through excuse provisions and exemptions that are based on drug and alcohol use. What we think is a better system is that people should always be able to be excused out of mutual obligations or have a reasonable excuse for not meeting a mutual obligation like attending a job interview because of drug and alcohol. But they must also be able to show that they're taking active steps to address that. And one of the important things we're doing inside this welfare reform is we are, for the first time, making it so that every single job seeker can actually use the fact that they are treating their problem, that they're trying to address the underlying causes of drug and alcohol problems. The fact that they are doing that, they can count towards their activity requirements, which are designed to help them find a job.
So okay, but you don't have any evidence, it's about helping people. The question is around evidence. You don't actually have evidence that this is going to work, do you?
Well, let's look at it in these terms.
No, but there's what either evidence know, or not. It's not terms. Do well, you have the well, evidence?
Okay, so an unemployed person is 2.4 times more likely, according to all the best research, to have difficulties with drug and alcohol as someone who is not. Now, what that indicates, which is something that all of us, I think, would understand as a matter of common sense, is that drug and alcohol problems cause a massive barrier for people to employment.
Yeah, no, that's not in dispute. Everyone knows that's the truth. But would this turn it around? That's where you need the evidence. And you can't point me to any evidence there.
Well, no, that's not the case. So, for instance, what we know is that if you can address people's underlying drug and alcohol issues, then you enhance their abilities to get employment. What I'm saying to you is at the moment, the system doesn't do that. So of course, we'll measure along the way improvements. I mean, the fact is that about 23% of people, so roughly a quarter, move off New Start within 3 months. Now, if we make significant welfare reforms that we're suggesting to mutual obligation, to compliance, to the way in which we deal with people with drug and alcohol issues, we would expect that kind of figure to improve. And of course, we will track and evaluate that. So,
and you'll dump it if it doesn't work?
Well, that's what we are doing with all of our measures. So our Tri-Test Learn Fund that I spoke about earlier, where $100 million is set aside to target groups with very bad outcomes in the welfare system, what we do is measure the improvement or otherwise of those groups, and we refund organisations that are providing a service that improves the situation, and we defund the ones that don't. So, for instance, with our drug testing reforms, we build in money to evaluate that trial. And of course, if it doesn't show better trajectories and outcomes for people inside the trial sites than comparative groups outside the trial sites, it's not something that's likely to get continued. Okay. But we are investing lots of money in measuring outcomes to develop that body of evidence. But the evidence does show that treatment can work. And where you are treated for drug and alcohol and the underlying causes, that increases your prospects of employment very significantly, which increases your chances in life for building a better and more productive life for you and your family.
Christian Porter, we know the government struggled to get its savings through the Senate, which is why you dumped the zombie cuts. Your colleagues have been talking about how you've been trying to find ways of bypassing the Senate. Is this now an active strategy, more crackdowns, trying to save money in your area without having to get it through in legislation?
Well, I mean, the ultimate purpose of welfare reform is to transition people in greater numbers and at greater speed from states of being dependent on a welfare payment to being employed. And we think that that in itself is the single first, final and foremost objective. Now, in the very long run, as has been the experience in New Zealand, transitioning people faster and in greater numbers from welfare into employment, obviously in the very long run.
So is that a strategy of yours to do this now throughout without having to go to take it through legislation through the Senate?
The strategy here is to improve individual people's lives by getting them into employment. And as I've noted to you earlier, these reforms that we're discussing now, whether they're rewriting mutual obligations, whether they're compliance, they actually cost money in the very early stages and over the out years of the budget. They are accompanied by very significant investments, $260 million designed.
So are your colleagues wrong? You're not trying to do this? You're not trying to find more savings? Because you're saying we're actually spending money.
Well, what I'm trying to do is create a sustainable long-term welfare system. Sustainable because all of its levers are directed at getting people off welfare as soon and in as large a number as possible into work. Now, if that has the long-run effect of making the system sustainable, which I believe it will, then that is a very, very positive thing. But the purpose of these reforms is to help individuals into employment and groups of individuals into employment who we know now have very bad outcomes.
Very briefly and quickly, because I've run out of time, on the Uluru statement, one of your colleagues, obviously from the National Party, George Christensen, says the proposals from the Indigenous delegates are dangerous. Is that helpful?
Look, I must say, just started to read the document carefully. My view, though, would be this, that it has strayed a very long distance from what was originally being spoken about in terms of what recognition in a constitutional setting might be. So it's much, much broader, I think, than some of the early ideas about what recognition in the Constitution
but is it dangerous?
Indigenous people would be. Look, as I say, I haven't read it in full yet. It's not probably language that I would use, but I do think that it's far broader than what was being canvassed earlier.
And you can't see that it would get support at a referendum?
Well, again, I've only just started reading a very long statement. So, look, I'd have to reserve my view on that until I've finished reading it. But this is something very, very different from what was being discussed not that long ago.
Christian Porter, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Patricia. Cheers.
That's the Minister for Social Services, Christian Porter. 0418 226 576 is the text line.